But ultimately, I think humans figure out how to assimilate a technology. Technology doesn't assimilate us.
Many think computing is about scientists, engineers, and mathematicians.
But if you've ever texted, emailed, friended, or checked your bank balance online, you know computing is about you. What happens when a computer appears to think like you? Artificial intelligence has been pursued in computer labs for decades. In 2011, an IBM supercomputer named Watson played against two humans in the TV game show Jeopardy, and Watson won. In this episode of Revolutionaries, you'll meet the human intelligence behind the artificial intelligence. IBM's Dr. David Ferrucci in conversation with Richard Waters of the Financial Times.
It's a tremendous privilege to be here, welcome you all, and to introduce Dave Ferrucci. Not many of you will know this, but Dave was actually destined for a completely different career as a doctor. Doctor of medicine rather than a doctor of computer
science. That's right, a real doctor. Right.
A real doctor. And brought up in the Bronx, and he was, he tells me he was heading for, he got as far as his MCATs, and the light bulb went off over his head, and he realized, you know, this was not the thing to do. And he actually got up in the middle of that exam.
Yeah, well, the exam that you would take to prepare for the MCATs,
right.
and it was in a preparation course, and you know, I had been getting so and so enamored by computers and the potential, and frankly, about artificial intelligence ever since I was introduced to them in high school. But I was on that course to become a medical doctor. And this is what my parents wanted me to do, and this is what it was like programmed in my brain. But little by little, I just got more and more fascinated by AI, by programming. I would stay up all night programming my, I guess it was an Apple IIe or something. You know, all night long. And so here I am, you know, on this course and this taking the MCAT preparation thing. And I opened it up, and I think it was an organic chemistry exam I had to take for the next 45 minutes. And I sat there and I said, you know what? I'm not going to be a doctor. And I just closed the book. And I went up to the proctor and I handed it in. And I said, you know, I'm leaving. I'm not going to be a medical doctor. He said, yeah, whatever. You still owe me the $500 for the course.
And then so Dave, now look, I'm still doing my introduction here, so...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't...
You were
so
taking too long,
so,
right?
So you became an inorganic man at that moment.
I became inorganic.
Completely inorganic. So from that moment, as you say, it was AI. The AI light bulb went off
right.
At a very early age. And so you then went on to Rensselaer, which I think is the oldest engineering school in the U.S.
That's right, yeah.
M.A., Ph.D., a career at IBM where you came and went two or three times in research. And really your career has, in research, followed or mirrored the trajectory of AI in its early days, I think. You know, expert systems you worked on when they were the big thing in the 80s.
Right.
Then there was the AI winter.
That's
you know,
right.
When the lights went out and everybody thought, you know, this is not really heading anywhere.
Right.
And then back to IBM
right.
In the mid-90s. To get back onto this trajectory, which has brought us here tonight to this wonderful demonstration of where computing power's got to. But let's go back to that, maybe that mid-90s point, if you like, and maybe start with where artificial intelligence had got to at that point. Because as John Hollower said at the beginning, it started out with such amazing hope and expectation in the late 50s, and then by the early 60s, I think everybody assumed that within a decade we'd have talking computers, and it didn't happen.
No.
But what went wrong? Were the expectations wrong? Did the technology not evolve?
I think the expectations were way off. I think we really, at the time, the industry sort of had no deep appreciation for how miraculous the human brain is, frankly. I think that, you know, what inspired me back in high school when I was first introduced to computers was the same thread that inspired many of the AI scientists at the time, which was you can sit down at this machine, you can imagine a procedure or a process, and you can encode that procedure, say, you know, do this, then do this, then do this, and the computer would do it. And so the immediate sort of next
thought was, well, gee, if I can reason and I can be conscious about how I reason, you know, I have rules like if this happens, then do this, and if that happens, then do this, and I have the power of this computer in front of me, it won't be long before I can just give it all these rules and it's just going to take off and it's going to work, you know, it's going to do what the human mind does. But that was sort of grossly off the mark. I think the way the human mind works and the way it encodes knowledge and the way it reasons is just far more complicated and far more mysterious than was originally imagined.
So it was a failure to conceive the complexity of the human mind rather than an overestimation of the technology back then.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's probably the right way to think about it. I think it's a little bit of both, but that.
I mean, the field of artificial intelligence is still dominated by this, you know, this thing, the Turing test, the idea that the end goal, in a way, is when a machine can appear to be like a human. And so Alan Turing set that test early on as a sort of you know, the real proof point. Was that is that just the wrong trajectory? And were people thinking that, you know, were they heading off in the wrong direction from the beginning?
Well, I think the Turing test is an inspirational test. I think it's still around, and it still means something, which is the computer behaving in a way that that is so human-like? It's hard for me to tell. I can't tell the difference, whether I'm interacting with a human or I'm interacting with the machine. And I think it sets a very, very tough goal. But I also think it's a little bit troublesome because of how general it is, right? If we think of it task by task, it's very different. So, you know, when we think about how McCarthy defined artificial intelligence, so, you know, a program is artificially intelligent if it performs a task, and if that task were performed by a human, we would consider the human intelligent. So it's a task-specific definition. So when, you know, Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, we thought, well, as far as chess goes, this computer is performing you know, at a human level. It's doing what a champion, you know, human can do at chess. So when we see Watson play Jeopardy, we're saying, you know, Watson is performing like a human at the game of Jeopardy. But, you know, can Watson sit down and have this conversation? No. Can Watson, you know, tell jokes? No. Watson, in fact, can't play chess unless it calls its cousin Deep Blue. But right, so
you end up
with a very task-specific perspective, whereas the Turing test is usually open, right? It says, you know, can you interact with this machine, and would you believe it's human? Well, we expect a lot more from humans than just to do these specific tasks.
But to go back to when you got into this field in the 80s, expert systems were based on this idea that you could reduce everything to a set of rules,
right,
and that if you could only learn all the rules and cram all the data in, then you would have a machine that would turn out the perfect answer.
Right.
Didn't work.
No, it did. I mean, so it worked to a degree, right? Because if you can encode the rules, you could say, you know, if you see a circular red rash, you know, and the person's visited Connecticut, you know, and this and that, then they have Lyme disease or something. Okay, that was one rule. You've got another billion to go. Right. So, and by the way, by the time you're done, there'll be 10 times more information, and you could start again. Right. So this you know, so if the domain was limited, the number of rules you needed to encode was limited. The way you would interact with the computer was directly connected to the way you express those rules. Then you could get it to do, you know, do impressive things. But when you had to really deal with information the way humans do, which is much more broad, much more generally, much more flexibly, it wasn't working.
No.
I'm sorry. So this sets up the real hard part of AI, which is how do we get computers to understand things in human terms, in, you know, human language. So something that can't be reduced to well-defined mathematics. And chess and understanding human language frame this problem, I think, nicely, because when we think about chess is this mathematically well-defined problem, right? A certain number of, you know, pieces, there's a finite grid,
each piece has an exact mathematically well-defined pattern in which it can move on the grid. And you could imagine now a computer can follow those rules, move those pieces around, and say, did I win yet? All right, let me try some other moves. Did I win yet? Let me try some other moves. So now if you can make this computer powerful enough to search that big space, try many, many different moves, and evaluate all these board configurations, it can start to do really well at chess. There's no ambiguity, there's no implicit, there's no confusion, there's no tacit information. It doesn't have to have any other background knowledge to play the game. So when I sit there and look at that, and maybe I'm a little bit biased because I stick at chess, but when I step back and look at that, I think it's a marvel that humans can play chess, not that computers can.
So chess is a machine function. That's the way I look at it, but
now when you get into understanding human language, now you're out of the element for the machine, you're into the human element.
So before we get on to that, let's then talk about what happened after 95. So you came back to IBM in Westchester, in the Watson Labs, to pursue this, and the field was starting to open up again. What new areas of research did you see that were starting to develop that gave you the confidence to think that you could move beyond where things had got stuck before? What were the strands?
So I got involved in software architecture and engineering, which I think, because I just liked to do it. In fact, it's interesting when you think about these classic, expert systems where you would write all these rules down, you sort of model the world. You'd say, there's this kind of concept, and there's people, there's places, there's time, people move, and you'd start to build this big model of how things worked in the world. This was fun to do, For a person, I was sort of a logician. I like logic. I like modeling things. I like breaking things down into their subcomponents. This was a lot of fun to do for someone of my ilk, anyway. And not generally fun. My kids would hate it. But anyway, so it was fun. But you started to realize it was very limited. It was because I was never going to be able to model everything, and things were constantly changing. And so what I started to get more and more interested in was methods and techniques for getting the computer to try to digest knowledge in the form that humans created it, right? Which is language. It's not just natural language that we speak in, but images, speech, text, right? So language. Language is uniquely a human artifact. Right? We create it to communicate with one another. And it's extraordinary in its efficiency, largely because we have a shared experience, of a shared an experience. So when I start speaking with you, you start nodding, you're understanding me. You're using a lot of background information to get that. If you had a very limited experience with different usage of those words, we wouldn't really be able to communicate at all, because unlike chess, there's not a specific meaning that we've all agreed to for every single word. It's about usage. I mean, one of the stories I like to tell is that I had two young daughters, and a very common experience in the Frucci household would be me yelling down to my daughters, "You guys got to come down here. This is really, really interesting." And I'd be, doing some experiment in the sink, or, doing something crazy that trying to stimulate them and excite them about science. "You guys got to come down here. It's really, really interesting." And so this was a common use as they were growing up with the word interesting. And when one of my kids was 7 years old, she stopped at the top of the stairs when I was yelling down, "Come down here, it's really interesting." And she said, "Daddy, interesting things are boring." And she wasn't making a joke, right? This was not a joke. This was an assertion, right? Because this was so every time she heard this word interesting, at least the most frequent and loudest times, was her association with that was the feeling of boredom.
So language has rules, but the rules change depending on the context, and humans make up the context
It's contextual, it's extremely flexible. Mm. A great example of context, of meaning being revealed getting more and more concrete as context comes in, right? So if I say to you, so the bat came flying through the window, So you're forming a mental image.
I'm thinking of a cricket bat because I'm British, but I understand what
you
you're
could
getting
be thinking. Well, yeah. Someone else out there is thinking about a fruit bat, right? Mm-hmm. Some flying creature, right? Flew through the window. But then I say to you, and then Johnny came running home. Right? Now the probabilities of what bat is sort of changing. What can it be now? Could Johnny maybe was running because he was scared of the fruit bat chasing him, or maybe he was running to home base, you know, in a game of baseball, and then the crowd cheered, right? So now you're convinced that what the meaning of bat is. So as the context unfolds, different mental images are lining up.
So we often talk about natural language recognition as the ultimate test of artificial intelligence. Is that right? Is it the hardest thing for a machine to do, or are there harder things?
So there are a lot of hard things to do, but I think
this is the one that you decided you were going to focus your life on.
This is the one that really kind of gets at the heart of it, in my opinion, because this deals with human meaning. Is humans assign meaning to the things around us? The only time we're going to get to be able to communicate fluently with computers if they can start to make the connections, right, that we do with language.
So you were focused on this field, and then a few years ago someone came up with a bright idea within IBM, let's play Jeopardy. How did that come about? What happened there?
Right. Well, so
that wasn't your idea, right?
It wasn't my idea to play Jeopardy. I because of my interests and the team I had built and the things I had been doing at that point for years, I was in a unique position to work on it, to respond to it, to want to
so
do
you,
it.
So you did you knew the hardware systems. You'd done the software architectures.
Software architecture and engineering. We invested in infrastructure, basically software programs that allowed you to build systems like Watson for some time, invested in the skills, the talented people on my team in natural language processing and knowledge representation and reasoning, another part of AI, and information retrieval and machine learning. All these people were there largely because I was collecting people of similar interests and focus over a decade.
But why Jeopardy?
So what happened with Jeopardy was Deep Blue, the computer that played chess, was a great success for IBM, and the executives were looking for, what's the next big thing?
They wanted to show off.
Yeah, an opportunity to show off, an opportunity to kind of advance the science in a way that would bring attention, that would kind of, wow and get the general audience to scratch their heads and go, what does this mean? This is really cool. What's going on? So they're looking, what's the next thing you could do? And Charles Luckel was a VP at IBM who was actually in a restaurant. He was one of the people thinking about what would be the next thing. And all of a sudden, everyone in the restaurant got up, went into the bar, and they were all fixated on the television. And it was Ken Jennings playing Jeopardy during his winning streak.
So he was there.
And so he thought, Charles Luckel thought, this could be pretty exciting. Can we get a computer to play Jeopardy?
But this was an executive, not a scientist. This was someone who didn't quite understand what that really meant.
Right.
And then he came to you and said, fix this. Not, for
nothing against executives. They're brilliant, pay my salary, and I love them. But he was not a person who understood this kind of technology. He was really, sort of person who sat there and said, can we get a computer to solve this? Would be a cool challenge to do.
And how did that go down when he came up with that bright idea?
So he talked to other executives about it. They actually, a few of them thought it was good. A few of them thought it was crazy. But then it was shopped around. In other words, the execs went around to a lot of the researchers and were looking for someone who thought that it could be done, someone who thought it was possible and who would kind of stand up to the task. And there was no one around for a couple of years. I was interested, but there were a lot of naysayers who were like, this is just, you'll never do this, you're going to fail, it's pure folly, you're going to destroy your career, blah, blah, blah. And I was still busy with the other stuff I was doing, the unstructured information management architecture, the sort of the foundation for building systems like this. And so around the end of 2006, I said, look, I'm so interested in this. Let me put together a few guys and do a feasibility study.
And in a few months, I'll come back and I'll say, look, I think this could be done. I think it's absolutely impossible. Just give me a chance to just make an informed decision about this, because I'm excited about it. I think it can be done. Let me argue it. You know, give me some time to argue why. So I did that and made the case. And the executive support, at that point, were willing to support it and take it forward. Now, even then, though, many people thought, this was going to fail. It was just a matter of time before they were going to bury me in a closet somewhere, and
I mean, even now, you talk to people in the field of artificial intelligence, and they say, I was talking to Rodney Brooks at MIT, and he said, if you go back 5 years and ask people, how long would it take to be able to do this? They'd have said 20 years, 30 years. I mean, certainly not a five-year horizon. But when you decided, this is it, I'm going to bet everything and go for this, what odds did you give yourself of achieving it in, what was it, a three-year time frame? I mean, it was a quick,
so what, quick thing. In all fairness, what I told the execs was I'd be able to do this in 3 to 5 years. I kind of made that up. I got lucky. I thought there was no way I could do it in less than three, not ever. And if I said more than five, I probably wouldn't have gotten the funding. So 3 to 5 was the right answer. We did it in four. The way I saw it was I didn't know exactly what the odds were. I had an intuition that, given what we knew about the technology, given, I had a team working in question answering, working in natural language processing, given what we knew about it, and given what the problem looked like, I thought we had a fighting chance. But I think more importantly, I believe that it was an absolutely irresistible challenge as far as I was concerned. In other words, I couldn't live with myself if I didn't try it. Because what I believed was that even failure would have been more informative to me, to my team, and to the science than success at anything else I could have thought. Guaranteed success, anything else I could have thought of. So it was the kind of challenges I would even learn from failure. Why, if we put the right resources and the right people and took what we believed was the right approach to the problem and we failed, We would have something important to say.
We wouldn't be sitting here talking about it now.
We wouldn't.
So let's
we
face
wouldn't,
it.
But
Nobel
I would,
failure
I would
does not
feel
work.
Good still. Believe no, you don't believe that.
Well, let's talk about exactly what it is you did. I mean, we got deep QA behind us up on the screen here. You started out by basically amassing your team, first of all, was, as you say, was a team you've been building up for a while. How big was it? How many people did you have? What kind of skills did they have?
So when we started off, it was about 12 people. And as I said earlier, we had computational linguists, information retrieval, knowledge representation and reasoning, machine learning, software engineering and architecture. So we had quite a variety of talent and skills in there, and I think that diverse set was important. And that's sort of what we started with. We started growing. So over the 4 years, we grew ultimately to about 26, 27 people total. Because at some point we had to, once the machine sort of got good enough at answering the questions, it was taking, so we kept driving accuracy. In other words, our ability to answer a question accurately, but also to compute an accurate confidence. One of the really sort of important challenges in Jeopardy, you kind of have to know what you know. You just can't say, oh, here's my top head, I don't know. And get it wrong, you lose a dollar value associated with the clue, your competitors chime in, you're in trouble. So computing an accurate probability that the answer was correct was actually very important. So the metrics we were driving was the ability to answer a lot of questions correctly, but also to be able to predict if your answer was likely right or wrong. And so when you see the game, you'll see that answer panel. And what that answer panel tells you is what its top three answers are and what its probability was. Mm-hmm. So we kept driving those numbers. But at some point, we got it to look like we were getting there. It looked like we were moving. We were going to able to do this. We were going to get accurate enough and predict probabilities well enough that we might be able to play this game. And it was taking 2 hours to answer a single question. Whereas the Jeopardy producers kept telling us it would be a very boring game. And so that's when we had to grow the team. We brought people on who specialized in optimizing the system. So in other words, so that we can start scaling the system out over not just one computer, but over what ended up being...
just bringing masses of power to bear on a single point in time.
So what ended up being 2,880 cores.
This is not an economic way to play a game and win
2,800. Well, you know, you say that, and that's true, I guess. But you look at what your comparison. You know, we wanted to... So Watson had to be completely self-contained, right? So just a human can't connect to anything and look anything up or talk to his cousin or anything. So, you know, Watson had to be completely self-contained, was not connected to anything at all. And when you compare, you know, what happened, talk about efficiency, the human brain, like, powered by what, a tuna fish sandwich, a glass of water, uses about 20 watts. Watson was the equivalent of 10 refrigerators. It used 80 kilowatts, 20 tons of air conditioning. So the human brain is more efficient.
So pound for pound, the humans are still in front.
Oh, yeah, you betcha.
So what is
deep... At that task.
So what is deep QA? How actually does it work?
So deep QA is the underlying architecture that Watson's built on top of. So it's, you know, as many computer systems are, it's sort of very layered. So, you know, you have the hardware, which was the IBM Power 750s, 2,880 cores of them, 15 terabytes of RAM. And on top of that was this other system that my team had built the four or five years previous, what we called UIMA, or UIMA, the Unstructured Information Management Architecture. This was kind of like the plumbing that allowed you to plug in many different algorithms and connect them together. So there was that. And then on top of that, we built Deep QA, which was the architecture that ultimately, you know, Watson was built on. And that's the brains, if you will, of the Jeopardy contestant, you know, Watson. And the way it would work is when a question comes in, so it has a topic, a category, and it comes in, and Watson tries to sort of understand it. And when I say understand, I don't mean the way humans understand it, because when you get language, you start connecting it to your experiences, your memories, your mental images, and so forth. The computer gets in, you know, text and parses it. So what I mean by parse is, like, when you were in high school or grammar school, you would diagram a sentence. What's the subject? What's the verb? What's the object? Prepositional phrase, object of the preposition, et cetera, et cetera. And so Watson would do that, so, you know, get that parse. And then it would try to understand what sort of what the words mean. Are there people in here, organizations in here, places, times, and how are they related? So it gets an interpretation of the question.
And it's just looking at words in context.
And it's just looking at words in context of the question. It has algorithms that look at cues, that try to assign semantics, like, this looks like a name. This looks like the name of a person. This looks like the name of a place. This looks like a time or a date. So it has those kinds of what we call semantics, like, you know, they would apply to that. But then it would come up with lots of different interpretations because it wasn't exactly sure. So it would generate different queries. So one of the principal ideas here was that because computers don't have a meaningful command of language the way we do, there was like no moment that we expected really understood anything. It was generating possibilities and then gathering more and more data and figuring out which one of those possibilities were going to make sort of be the most supported by the data. This is the way to think about it. So it would take the question, it would generate different interpretations of the question, it would fire out many, many queries, and it would bring back documents and passages from the things that it read a priori, right? From encyclopedias, from dictionaries, from thesauri, from scripts, from plays, from books. It would bring back all these pages and documents and paragraphs and passages, and that might have something to do with the question. And then from there, it would generate possible answers. Like, it would try to read them and say, well, this might be an answer, that might be an answer. So now it would have, like, you know, let's say 100 possible answers. And then it would, each one was sort of like a competing hypothesis. So Watson will say, well, okay, So maybe George Washington's the answer, or maybe Christopher Columbus is the answer, or maybe Vasco da Gama is the answer, maybe. So we have 100 of these possible answers. And then for each one, it would say, okay, now it's going to try to gather enough evidence to prove that that was the right answer. So now let's say you had 100 possible answers. For each one, it may, let's say, went out and gathered 100 pieces of evidence. So other documents and passages and facts that might support, you know, Vasco da Gama or Christopher Columbus as the answer. But these were kind of independent threads. So it's kind of competing hypotheses go out. And then, so now if I had 100 answers and 100 pieces of evidence, that's 10,000 answer evidence pairs. And then it would have, we have all these algorithms that the researchers have developed over the years that we're working on the project, you know, to analyze the evidence, like analyze that paragraph or that document, that fact, and come up with an estimation that evidence supported that answer. Oh, I'm reading something here about Vasco da Gama. It says Vasco da Gama, you know, landed in Cappet Beach. And the question's asking about arriving in India. Oh, that looks like it's related. So this looks like it's good evidence because, you know, I have this other thing about Christopher Columbus thinking he was in India. And in this time, right, so that's maybe some evidence for Christopher Columbus. So do this for 100 possible answers, 100 algorithms. Now you have millions of what we call scores, confidences, numbers between 0 and 1 that say, 50% chance, you know, 0.5 chance that this evidence supports this answer is the right answer. So a million of these scores. So now you got to combine them all, and at the end you get a ranked list of answers where each answer has a probability associated with it, like 60%. So if that probability was over a threshold, say 50%, say, Watson would want to answer. If the probability was below a threshold, again, say 50%, Watson would say, I don't want.
But this, all of this sounds, forgive me, but it sounds like your bat coming through the window. It's the way the human brain works when you're trying to work out context, probability, you're looking for more information, you're weighing up various scenarios before you, and then maybe you're only 60% sure it was a fruit bat rather than a cricket bat.
Right.
So isn't this the way the human brain works? And are there any direct parallels here that you were modeling?
Well, when we started the project, we certainly didn't start out thinking we're going to model a human brain. We really approached it as engineers. You know, how do you solve this task? And we had people talented in all these areas of computer science, not cognition. So we didn't have neuroscientists. We didn't have cognitive psychologists. But when you reflect on how it worked, you would see these analogies. You would think, well, gee, I mean, I don't know about, you know, how a brain is organized physiologically and you know, neurons and so forth. But what I could tell you is that I'm conscious of a similar procedure. So, you know, the computer is using a similar procedure that you might be conscious of that you use when you answer these questions. And that, you know, that's fair. And there are times when we would think, we look at a question and say, you know, it's not getting this right, and we would think, how would a human do this? Right? But we're not thinking about how does a brain work necessarily, but what procedure are we conscious of, you know, when we do this?
Wow. The other aspects to this, of course, were, you know, obviously a massive amount of data that you could subject your system, you could pump through your system to test.
Right.
Machine learning sort of feedback loops to learn from it and move it on. I mean, it sounds like, you know, you had a whole lot of different advances coming together at the same time that made this possible. It simply wouldn't have been possible 5 years before.
Well, I think there are quite a number of things. I mean, massive parallelism and the power of the computers itself. Mm-hmm. The access to large amounts of data that we were able to use to have the machine train. This goes back to this notion of, can we acquire knowledge from naturally occurring? Can we acquire and interpret language? Can we reason over naturally occurring knowledge? What I mean by naturally occurring knowledge is the stuff that humans generate to commute. You know, we produce knowledge by the droves, right? We're prolific.
So did you go out on the web and crawl for information?
Yes, we had encyclopedias. I mean, some stuff was open source, stuff from the web. Encyclopedias, dictionaries, thesauri, books, plays, scripts, the Bible, Shakespeare. All that stuff was in there. The equivalent of about a million books or so. But then we would, we would process it and generate, you know, more what we call metadata, so the computer would analyze and so forth. It's not a lot of information on web scale, interestingly enough, right? I mean, I think the raw content was around 100 gigabytes. The web is petabytes. I mean, it's just, you know, it's, but on a human scale,
it's an enormous amount of information, right? Can you imagine sort of having access to a million books, right? I mean, so, and when I say the computer Watson is 15 terabytes, that's 15 terabytes of RAM. So it used 15 terabytes of working memory to analyze and understand and do that process I was describing earlier. It wasn't 15 terabytes of raw content. It was only about 100 gigabytes of raw content.
All right. So before we talk about some of the implications of this, of what you've achieved, I do have one question about Watson I've been wondering about is, you know, does it have an unfair advantage on buzzer speed? Because I can't believe I could press a buzzer as fast as a machine could press a buzzer.
Are there angles here that you're able to manipulate? You can't, but Ken Jennings can.
Really?
So actually, really, and here's why. So so technically speaking, if you use a complete sort of level playing field, yeah, a computer's reaction speed is faster, certainly. Now, the idea behind putting a computer up and playing Jeopardy was, you know, you have a computer, you have a human, they both have their, you know, pros and cons, they both have their strengths and weaknesses, but the interface to the game should be functionally equivalent. So the human had to press a handheld buzzer, so did the computer. So we actually had to build a little hand. And
no.
Yeah, seriously.
All right.
It doesn't look like a hand. It looked like a solenoid switch with a plunger. And
all right, but we'll trust you on this one. So there was no cheating there. Any other?
No, wait. I mean, I didn't finish, but I'm happy to stop there. They're like, no. So you know, it would actually push the button. It would push the button down. But even with that mechanical device, it was, you know, still faster than a human's reaction time. But what happens, what humans can do is they would anticipate. So what really good Jeopardy, the professional, you know, Jeopardy players are extraordinary on the buzz. In fact, Ken Jennings was amazing, right? I mean, he outbuzzed basically all his competitors. His, you know, average take on a board, what I mean by take is like how many of the questions you got to answer first. His average take was 62% of a game. His average. He did 70, he did 81% take. This is because he's clobbering them on the buzz. And, you know, so we brought Ken Jennings' game to Ken Jennings, where, you know, we had now, did it mean that we couldn't lose the buzz? Absolutely not. And in fact, we did lots of trials with humans. And what Ken did, and what good human players do, is they listen to the speech, listen to Alex speak, and then they time it. So they anticipate when the buzz is going to be enabled. And they do that remarkably well. So we time them coming in the single-digit milliseconds, 4 milliseconds, 2 milliseconds,
wow.
right on the nose. So we couldn't get into this game without being, because once you could do the question answering, once you could do the buzzing, once you could do the probability stuff, once you could do all that other stuff, then you need to be able to compete on the buzz. So we couldn't come in with this expectation, oh, humans took 200 milliseconds. Absolutely not, you know, absolutely not true. So we had to get that speed so that when that question came in, and Watson had to compute its answer and its confidence fast enough to be able to get in there and compete with the humans. And now humans, you know, weren't as consistent. In other words, they couldn't come in single-digit milliseconds very often, but they could do it. Watson's advantage was that it was more consistent. It could consistently come in, you know, quickly. Mm-hmm. Watson lost the buzz a bunch of times. In fact, its take on the final games was around the same thing. It was like 61 or 62%. Its take, in terms of how many questions it answers first, in that game against Ken and Brad, was Ken's average.
So there's a lot of technique here. There's a lot of buzz technique
into
this.
Bet.
So the humans might still come ahead on intelligence.
The humans come ahead in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the implications and uses of what you've done here.
Humans built Watson. Just want to point that out.
Well, we'll talk about some of the implications of that maybe. But first of all, in terms of games, so chess has now succumbed to computers. Natural language games have succumbed to computers. What's next? What about poker bots, for instance?
Poker? They have that?
Well, they play pretty well. Machines play pretty well, but humans still can outbluff a machine, right, in poker. I mean, are there any other games that you have an eye on or you think would be a real challenge for a machine?
I'm out of the game business.
You're out of the game business.
I tried to convince IBM that we could generate a revenue stream by winning at Jeopardy, but no.
Challenges. No other big challenges in games.
There might be. I mean, I haven't put a lot of thought into it, but I mean, that's not where that's not where we want to take Watson, right. I think.
So, real life applications. You're already taking it into healthcare.
Yes.
So, how is it different from those expert systems you were talking about before? Should we think about it in the same sort of terms, a little smarter?
So I get very excited about this because I think it has a lot of the promise that I think the expert systems that we imagined in the 80s had, but it's different in such an important and fundamental way. So what we mean by expert systems is computer systems that kind of can reason over knowledge. So they could sit there and say, well, I'm observing this, and based on what I know, here's what the solution might be, or here's what the right next action might be, or whatever. So they could, think in that way, right? They could reason. But reasoning over this structured knowledge was a problem because it was hard to capture and maintain a mathematization of an entire domain. Imagine sitting there and trying to encode all the models that represented, medicine, and all the rules, and all the mathematical axioms. I mean, it's just very, very, very hard to do. So the promise of Watson is that it can reason over unstructured information. So it could reason over language. It could reason over knowledge in the form that humans are creating it. So if humans don't naturally mathematize knowledge for a computer, what they do naturally do is they write textbooks. They write papers. They write articles. They report on their results. They write about their experiences. This is what they do very naturally in natural language. So if we can get a computer to reason over natural language, now we have something that can scale. I mean, by scale is that it could start to do a lot of useful things without a lot of work on our part. We do our thing, which is to write stuff in natural language, and then let computers do their thing over that natural language. It will never perform in the same way that we expected expert systems to perform. Expert systems were extremely precise. Right, they would do an exact rule. If there was a circular rash and it needed exactly circular rash, and then it would tell you exactly what to do. So they're very precise. And they could do long, long chains of reasoning. So if you asked it why, it would show you like a 5,000 line deductive proof. That wouldn't be very useful to you, but you might sit there and say, well, it must have thought a lot. What we want Watson to do is deliver explanations in your words, in the words of humans. So in other words, we want it to say, here's why it might be Lyme disease, and here's why it might be arthritis. And my explanation is not a precise 5,000 line deductive proof. My explanation are these following pieces of information from these references. If you read this and then read this and read this, you'll know exactly why I was more confident in Lyme disease than arthritis. So you're bringing an explanation to the human, to the decision maker, based on natural language content in their own terms. So this is a very, very different way of thinking.
So medical students spend the first 2 years studying sciences, anatomy, and so on, and the organic chemistry that you are so keen on. So the question is, why can't we encode all that knowledge once and for all and create a basic medical diagnostic system and a smart medical training system that would simply
it's a great question. And the reality is that there are many diagnostic expert systems today that by some measures, by quantitative measures, perform as well as doctors. They predict as well as doctors do. They're not, they have not been widely adopted, and I think there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the primary ones is that it's very hard to keep them current. They're very narrow. They work in that one field where you wrote the rules for. And then that's it. Kind of keeping them up to date and current requires a dramatic effort. And their explanations, why they're coming up with these answers, are sort of these very static rules. And they don't give you the context. They don't give you the source. They don't let you as a human really judge the evidence. So I think these prior systems are brittle, narrow.
they don't give you the kind of information you're comfortable with, ultimately.
So which are the fields of knowledge where that approach works? Medicine, obviously, law. Which others? Which areas are on your checklist of places to go with Watson?
So I think healthcare medicine is certainly one. I think law is possible. Law is, I think, brings its own challenges. We talk about finance, but not in the traditional way. Not transaction processing systems, not trading systems, but rather
risk management.
Or services. Can I understand what's a good product or not, depending on a set of criteria and things like that. So again, at any time you're exploring possibilities, and you know that there may be different alternatives, different options, and you want to evidence those options, and you want to evidence those options from a body of mostly natural, combination of structured and unstructured knowledge.
You talk about this as a way of making human decisions more informed and supporting humans, and yet quite naturally it raises fears amongst people about what it'll do to their jobs. So it may well be that I would trust a machine ultimately to make a smarter decision than my doctor in terms of a diagnostic choice. How do you see this? Does this replace jobs? So for instance, you can imagine there are all kinds of areas where we welcome if it did replace human beings. In lots of customer support areas, it would be wonderful to have an intelligent agent that responded to you and gave you the answers you wanted, without these awful decision trees.
Are you saying the current agents are not intelligent?
Well, I'm not saying it's all bad here. It would improve the quality of our lives, but what will it do to information jobs, to white-collar jobs that haven't really had to compete with machine intelligence before?
I think in general, the trend we see with technology always is causing transitions, causing change. I think that's not new, right? As we develop more and more newer technologies that perform these various tasks, there's always a transition that we go through. But ultimately, I think humans figure out how to assimilate a technology. Technology doesn't assimilate us. And a lot of people, you say, Watson, next thing Skynet, take over the world. We're all going to get eaten by computers.
But you're making a leap there, which we don't necessarily need to make. We can take this one step at a time before we get to Skynet. If, for instance, how do we audit or monitor the quality of the output of a machine like Watson? If we're going to use it for decision support, how do we know ultimately that this is really valuable information?
So great. So is it adding value? And I think the one way to judge that is ultimately are humans using it? Are they finding it useful? If you talk about healthcare, which is kind of largely where my mind is at, I don't expect Watson to be making the decision. I expect the physician, the caregiver team to be making the decisions, to be making the judgments. I don't believe that you can take, especially in healthcare, I don't believe you could ever be taking that away from the humans. What you want the computer to do is inform them, is to ensure that they are considering all the options, that they have access to the best evidence in support of those things, that the computer helps them collaborate in sort of an informed way, bringing the information they need together. How do you judge it? Is it being used?
When you look at the history of human and computer interaction, that seems somewhat idealistic. If you look at the recent history of the financial sector, for instance, where that's a sector that's invested very heavily in risk management systems,
right,
trading support systems,
right,
and some of the most advanced systems in the world, and yet what that leads to is an undue reliance or confidence in models that are ultimately unsound. So although you say these are wonderful systems that can support us, actually that isn't what experience has taught us so far.
So when you think about systems like that, they're making certain decisions and they're taking action often on those decisions, and those models are ultimately not accessible, right? The people who built them understand them. I think what we're trying to do with Watson is, in fact, people often make this sort of have this misconception about Watson from a statistical versus rule-based technique. So I say, you know, Watson is not rule-based in that traditional expert system way. And people immediately jump to this notion that it's statistical, in that what it's doing is it's looking at patterns, like let's say in the case of healthcare, it's looking at your electronic medical record, and based on looking at many of them, it sees a pattern that says, oh, here's what your diagnosis is. And there's no explanation. That's not what we're doing with Watson. That's not the expected role of Watson. What Watson is doing is connecting that input information to possible outcomes, possible diagnosis, or possible treatments. And what it's doing is providing you a chain of explanations based on sources of human knowledge. So you're going to sit there and you're going to see that and you're going to say, yes, that's the information I needed to make that judgment. That's a very different interaction than letting a computer independently make a judgment and not even having an understanding of why, because it was a closed statistical model. And you know, this is kind of getting into the pros and cons of some of this stuff, of the actual techniques that we imagine. But what I imagine here is producing a body of knowledge that would persuade a human, yeah, this looks like the right thing to do.
Final question, what's your next big rash move? What do you want to do next? Or have you, is this it now? Have you found your life's work?
No, I'm not there yet. I wish I was, but I'd love to write a book. I would be satisfied if, you know, I came personally, sort of came full circle. You know, I got out of being a medical doctor. I was very interested in medical expert systems, and I saw this problem. And I would feel really good if we got to a point with this technology that it couldn't reason over unstructured content. It could provide really powerful decision support, you know, bring knowledge to my fingertips without having to hire droves of mathematicians and logicians to encode all that knowledge, but it can do it over the naturally occurring knowledge that we use to communicate. So if we could build, if Watson can reason over unstructured information, we can get expert systems to operate over unstructured information, I would call it quits.
So this is about taking the building blocks you've already built and tuning it,
absolutely.
Actually using it.
Take it to the next level, yeah.
All right, well, Dave Ferrucci on that. Thank you very much indeed.
Artificial intelligence, or is Watson something more? When you explore the history of computing, you connect the past to the future. We'll see you next time on the Computer History Museum presents Revolutionaries.